Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take Aim, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I'm Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with Accuracy in Media. Today I will be going solo. Don Irvine, AIM's chairman and my co-host, is not available today. But we have a great lineup. We have two really great guests. One will be with us shortly. He is Brian Jennings, the author of a new book called Censorship, The Threat to Silence Talk Radio. And later on, we have Matt Welch, the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. We are going to be discussing with our first guest, Brian Jennings. We're going to be talking about the new fairness doctrine. We're going to be talking about issues related to talk radio, efforts to censor conservative voices. And in the second part of the show, the second half hour, we're going to be having, Matt Welch, and we're going to be talking about a very interesting topic, this being the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Soviet Union and how little attention is being paid. Well, there's much attention being paid to other topics like 60th anniversary of the People's Republic of China, of Communist China, and so many other far less significant things that have happened. But anyway, we also, I want to tell you while we're waiting for our guest about an event taking place next Friday, October 23rd here in Washington. It is AIM's 40th anniversary conference, and we have a great lineup of people. You can go read about it and sign up for it, and we hope you will attend if you're in the area. Go to aim.org/events. And some of the people that will be speaking there, we have Representative Lamar Smith of Texas, who is the chairman of the Media Fairness Caucus. We have John Fund of the Wall Street Journal, Andy McCarthy, senior fellow at National Review Institute, and a regular contributor to National Review, who is the person who prosecuted the original World Trade Center bombers. We have Ron Kessler, who used to be with the Washington Post, and he's written so many great investigative books, and he's going to be talking to us about his journey and about investigative reporting. We also have Cliff Kincaid and Trevor Loudon, who will be talking about some of the radical roots of President Obama. We have Anita Moncrief, of formerly of Acorn, who is now a whistleblower. We have Mark Morano of Climate Depot, and David Appel, a science writer and journalist, who will be talking about global warming, along with Ann McElhaney, the director of a film, Not Evil, Just Wrong. And also, we're going to have a panel on new media. And so I think you would find it very interesting. We think C-SPAN will be covering it, but you never know with them until the last day or so. But it's certainly been brought to their attention, and they normally cover our events like this, so we're hoping for that. We're going to get into here in just a minute, talking about with Brian Jennings about the Fairness Doctrine, his book, Censorship, The Threat to Silence Talk Radio. AIM put out a book last year called The Death of Talk Radio by our editor, Cliff Kincaid. He was co-author of that, and we've covered much of this same ground, but Brian's brought some new perspective to it, and from his particular point of view as a programming head to over 40 radio stations, he is one of the sort of founders, one of the fathers of talk radio, of conservative talk radio, and he's got a lot of great things to say about this. And believe me, it is in jeopardy. You can be sure that the Obama team in power would love to silence Fox News. I think they've made that clear recently with their putting Anita Dunn up on CNN's Reliable Sources this past Sunday and going after Fox News, saying that they are an arm of the Republican Party. And the day that Obama went on and gave 5 interviews on Sunday morning, he refused to go on Fox. So there is a war there. I think it's plain to see, and they are trying to they are trying to silence much of what's going on talk radio, and we think that really needs to be exposed, needs to be fought and dealt with, and I think the best tonic for that is shining a light on the subject, and that's what we're hoping to do here today. I believe our guest is calling in any minute now, and let's see, let me just give you a little background on Brian. He is one of the nation's top talk radio programmers. He served as the national VP of talk programming for Citadel Broadcasting, one of the nation's largest radio companies. He was in that position for more than a decade, and he was also programming head to over 40 radio stations nationwide. According to Talkers Magazine, he is also one of the founding fathers of the conservative talk radio format. He is also a national award-winning journalist. His many awards include Columbia University's DuPont Award. He has also worked as a consultant to national personalities such as Oliver North, Michael Reagan, Alan Colmes, Dick Cavett, and others. And as I mentioned, he is the author of a new book, Censorship, The Threat to Silence Talk Radio. Welcome, Brian.
Well, good day to you, and thank you so much.
Thank you for coming on Take Aim. So I've just given your bio and very impressive, and tell us how and when did you get involved with talk radio?
I got involved with talk radio more years than I care to admit, about 40 years ago, as a matter of fact, and I've been in the medium ever since basically 1968. So I have a long history with a lot of radio stations in my career and a lot of great talent, and I've seen the format evolve from its infancy to what it is today, and it's grown exponentially, in the last 20-25 years because we had the foresight to repeal the Fairness Doctrine at that point.
Well, tell us about that era. You came in, as you said, in the 60s. Fairness Doctrine, which, you know, we've written quite a bit about too, lasted from 1949 to 1987. I remember while it was still going on, I the only talk radio people I remember listening to were Larry King and Barry Farber, and the rest of the famous names in radio were either disc jockeys or newsmen. But tell us about that era, what it was like for talk radio, and was there sort of this burgeoning movement waiting to come on the scene?
Well, there was. Back in the day, when we had to observe the Fairness Doctrine, we didn't opinionate on the radio. If we did, we had to offer equal and opposing viewpoints, basically. And that prevented a lot of ownerships around America from doing just that because, excuse me, they were so afraid of being turned into the FCC or held liable to a potential fine if they didn't present an opposing viewpoint. And it was also a record-keeping mess. You could reach out to your opponent, and they would never take you up on it. We had to keep documents at our radio stations to prove that we tried to reach out, and if we didn't, we could be fined. We could lose our license, our broadcast license, potentially. It and then all of a sudden there was a huge movement by broadcasters who thought we weren't being treated equally as our print brethren were. They could opinionate, they could write editorials, they had nobody looking over their shoulders to do so. So we felt very strongly that we didn't have the same free speech rights as our print brethren did. And it mushroomed all at the same time. Basically, President Reagan took office. He repealed the Fairness Doctrine because he very much felt that it was an assault upon First Amendment rights of broadcasters.
So I think the argument, though, has been, well, the people on these radio stations, they are being given public airwaves, so they have a different standard than someone just buying their own newsprint and newspaper and putting out their message that way. So is there any merit to that argument?
I don't believe there is, because who says they're public airwaves? It was Herbert Hoover who basically said there were public airwaves back in the 1920s. And it was because they decided they could license the airspace. And they wanted to control radio back then. They wanted to control it so that they could control basically thought in America. I think it was very Orwellian to begin with. Who can control the airspace? Isn't it God-given? Isn't, you know, a piece of it right here for you and me both? I mean, it's ridiculous to think that we can govern what we say through these airwaves rather than just govern the licensing of the airspace to give to broadcasters. I'm amazed by that argument. And the other thing is that there's so much viewpoint anyway through all forms of media, whether it be over the radio, over the airwaves, over TV. The internet has opened up an explosion of viewpoints. We don't need government going around regulating speech content. That is so Orwellian. It's borders tyranny. To me, it's just the most oppressive thing I could think of.
Wasn't the argument back in the 20s based on scarcity of radio spectrum, I guess you would say? Is that the way?
Probably that was a huge argument back then. Of course, we just used AM radio spectrum, and back then there were just a few hundred radio stations that were licensed in America. It grew to about 2,000, I think, in 1949. And without other media, I think you could make a case that you could control or should have some boundaries in what was being said. Otherwise, one medium such as radio could control a lot of thought, no question.
But that's not the case
today.
Right. So once the Fairness Doctrine ended in 87, tell us about the next few years, how it began to emerge, where opinion radio hit the airwaves.
We had about 100 radio stations in the talk radio format back in 1987. That's all. And today we have approximately 2,000 or slightly more. And it just exploded out of the gate when all of a sudden we were free to express our opinion without worry that we would be fined or potentially lose a broadcast license. In other words, we could be free speech. We could purport to have free speech in America, finally. And it just exploded out of the gate. There was so much pent-up demand for it. And the American public decided that this was a great thing and listened to these radio stations. The ratings exploded. Revenue followed. And the free marketplace, all of a sudden, determined what it wanted, what it was going to listen to. And now today we have a group of very liberal people who, because conservative viewpoints are prevalent in talk radio today, want to control the airwaves once again because they don't like what they're hearing. And they think it's gotten too powerful, too out of control, when in fact they also have their liberal viewpoints on numbers of radio stations around America, and they just don't like the conservative viewpoint, and they want to shut it down. And it's so anti-free speech, it's just incredulous in my mind that there would be a movement for this in America.
Well, we'll get back to that a minute. I want to go over a little more history first, because generally we think of, looking back, that Rush Limbaugh was sort of the first to emerge on the scene nationally as a major voice for the conservative viewpoint. Were there others that were national before Rush, or was he really the first one that really caught on big?
He was the first one who really caught on big with an opinion. And, yes, there were others, but they weren't opinion programs. They were advice programs for the most part.
Okay.
And but Rush was the first out of the gate with an opinion program.
And why do you feel that progressive talk radio, why are there no liberal Rush Limbaughs, that anyone that has made it that big?
I think basically, and I felt this for a long time, number one, they aren't entertaining and they don't hit a cross-section of America that's big enough to support what they're hearing and their viewpoint. I have programmed progressive talk as well in my career, and never did it work. I put it on about six or seven radio stations when I was with Citadel, and it just didn't work. People didn't want to hear what they were saying. And it's just like if you're a merchant and have a store, if you have a product that doesn't move, you get rid of it. The marketplace determines what is popular and what is not. And the marketplace so far has said conservative point of view is what they want to hear on radio. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't some progressive stations, liberal stations. I'm not going to call them progressives. They're liberal.
Mm-hmm.
That don't work in America. There are many. Many stations that do. KGO in San Francisco is considered a liberal station for the most part.
And as far as
news oriented.
As far as the network, there's Air America, which had a number of scandals in its early years, and then went into bankruptcy, and then was taken out of bankruptcy by Stephen Green, the brother of Mark Green, the person who ran for mayor of New York. And what is the status of Air America today?
It is struggling just like they were in the past. They have maybe a few more affiliates, but nothing major, nothing out of the ordinary. And their ratings are about the same. It's pretty meager for that liberal point of view and for Air America. I would say this about Air America. They have a management team that is good. They have a very strong management team, as a matter of fact. But so far, it just hasn't really struck a chord with America, except in a few pockets here and there. But as far as the breadbasket of America and for the mainstream of the radio listeners in America, it just has not been a bell ringer.
Well, I think another reason is that many people would say, for liberals, there are so many places mainstream for them to get their news, whether it's NBC or NPR or, all through the mainstream media, so they don't really need the alternative source of information that talk radio provides for conservatives.
Absolutely correct. NPR, liberals will listen to NPR, and they gravitate toward it. And why would they need another liberal radio station for that? And this is really what's amazing to me. The liberal establishment won't admit that NPR is liberal. They want more networks out there in their camp. It's a cultural war we're facing, whereas conservatives really only have conservative talk radio and Fox News. It's a very small piece of the overall media pie when compared to the other mainstream media, NPR, and all the sources that you can get liberal points of view in America on. The argument is ridiculous on their part. They're absolutely nuts if they think that conservative talk radio is dominating America. It's laughable.
Well, let me ask you kind of a technical question. What regarding ratings, I think people wonder, hey, I'm sitting in my car, I'm punching the buttons, listening to different. How does anyone measure who and how many are listening to any radio show at any given time to come up with these statistics that we see? Is that a reliable measurement, in your opinion?
Well, it's not necessarily reliable. You're absolutely right about that. Many radio programmers have questioned the the ratings and the statistics that are given to us by the companies who go out and rate radio. But it's what we have. We have to live with what we get, because advertisers buy what ratings are established.
Well, what is it based on?
It's based upon the number of listeners in a given market that tune to one radio station as opposed to others. Now it's called a company called Arbitron controls all radio ratings in America. And most markets are going to what they call a personal people meter, where it's a pager-like device that picks up radio signals that the person hears, registers them with Arbitron, and from that they can generate ratings in a market. that is spreading throughout America, whereas beforehand it had been done by a diary handwritten method. You would sit down and write down the stations that you had listened to each week and send it to Arbitron. The personal people meter doesn't have to recall what you think you heard in that day or week. It instantly generates the recognizable signal and registers that as what the person is listening to. So it's real listening and in real time.
And then I suppose advertisers voting with their dollars, if they don't get a good return on their ads running it on, you know, certain shows, then they'll take it to other shows and see where they get a better response. So
that's
time,
exactly right, and that's one reason the conservative talk radio has flourished, is because so many people who support the format are entrepreneurs, are small businessmen, small business people, men and women across America, who generate jobs and who fuel the economic engine of America. And they have the core values that a conservative would have. They have to make a payroll. They have to pay their taxes. And they believe in those things. And they don't believe in big government. And therefore, they gravitate toward the conservative mindset in radio today and support that. Whereas on the progressive or liberal viewpoint stations, they hear the kind of things that are for big government, and government straightening this out, and government doing this, and higher taxes are needed for this. And that just is so anti-small business in America that's why the conservative radio and conservative viewpoint works so well.
So let's get into the nuts and bolts of your book and talk about recent and current efforts to reinstate a fairness doctrine. I know a couple years ago there was legislation by Congresswoman Louise Slaughter and Maurice Henschy that ended up really going nowhere. And then you had this report from the Center for American Progress talking about different ways. They say, oh, no, we don't want a fairness doctrine, but what? What did this call for? And talk about this, these recent efforts to do something along these lines.
Started basically right after President Reagan repealed the Fairness Doctrine, and as you mentioned, Slaughter, Henschy, and others tried to get a Fairness Doctrine back in, and of course they were threatened with veto by the Republican administrations at the time. When President Bush won his first election, Democrats were incredulous. When he won the second election, they couldn't believe it, and they vowed basically at that time that it was because of conservative talk radio. Conservative talk radio got Bush elected. People like George Soros started funding left liberal organizations such as Media Matters for America, had ties with the Center for American Progress, the CAP report that we hear so much about in this regard. What that report did when it was issued in June of 2007 was basically call for a return of fairness doctrine-like values without calling for the fairness doctrine. They made a point in the report to say we don't favor the fairness doctrine, but we do favor this agenda as getting radio under control. One of those things was to reduce the length of a license from 8 years down to 3 or even 2 in some cases. 3 years is pretty much what is going to become standard, I think. And the other thing that they suggested was that broadcasters should have to pay a license fee and give it to public broadcasting if they didn't meet the standards set forth in this report. So in other words, it would be a tax on commercial broadcasters for public broadcasters. Well, why would they do that if they didn't think that the public broadcasters, number one, were in their camp? It's just a ridiculous report. Part of this report was written by Mark Lloyd, who is now sitting as, quote-unquote, the chief diversity officer in the FCC. And his writings have been outrageous, how he hates the conservative viewpoint, how he really does hate Rush Limbaugh and so forth. And it's just an amazing...
Admires Hugo Chavez.
Admires Hugo Chavez. Good point. I mean, this is a man who has taken over his country's media, his radio stations in Venezuela, and is a dictator. Absolute communist dictator. Has taken over business after business. And Mark Lloyd values what he has done. It's just amazing that we could have somebody in government who has view or expressed these kind of viewpoints and put him into a potentially major role which could impact conservative values and conservative radio in America. It's very highly suspect.
So what do you expect to happen in the near future, and what can people do to try to block it?
Well, I think that there is a lot of awareness, number one. I've spoken all over America many times on many stations and many shows. So has our conservative hosts such as Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh, all good friends. And they have elevated this discussion, pointing out what could happen. I think if it happens in America, if there's any of this that happens, we will have the Tea Party of Tea Parties. You haven't seen a Tea Party yet, if some of this happens. My guess is that they will continue to subtly drive a wedge against conservative talk radio, such as appointing people like Mark Lloyd to the FCC. They will subtly require more diversity of programming through license renewal and try to obliterate conservative values from the radio. I think they will do that. And they will say, but it's not the fairness doctrine. There's a better way to do it. In fact, they have said that. I quoted a person from the Free Press who said that exact same thing in my book. There is a better way to do this than the fairness doctrine.
The Free Press being the organization financed by George Soros, right?
Yes, sir. Correct.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they know exactly what they're doing, but yet, oh, we don't favor the fairness doctrine. There's a better way to do it. And I think we need to be very aware of this.
Do you expect any of this to come through the legislative process, or is it all going to be done through the FCC, basically an executive branch and presidential appointments?
I expect none of it to be done through the legislative branch because they don't want to take the heat. They don't want to have to go back to face the voters and say, hey, we voted for this, because it's sure suicide, political suicide. I think absolutely it will be done through regulation and through very subtle regulations through the FCC. And this is why you find people like Mark Lloyd in the FCC.
And do you think they also have designs on cable TV and the Internet? In other words, again, the rationale for the talk radio is that these are public airwaves, but cable and Internet is not public airwaves. Are they going to try to expand their intrusion into those areas as well?
Well, they're absolutely making waves toward that end, and have spoken, many of them have spoken against Fox News, for instance, just recently in the news. The White House basically declaring war on Fox News. Fox News is not an over-the-air news presentation. It's a direct connection to your TV through your cable. But yes, they would love to control it. There's no question. They hate the viewpoint. They hate it, and they will do anything they can to obliterate it. I think this is a movement to kill conservative values, and the best way they feel they can do this is to kill conservative media.
Are there any other main points from your book that you would like to express? We're starting to run out of time here, and I want to give you a chance to both plug your book where people can get it and tell us any main theses or points in your book that we haven't discussed yet.
It's available on Amazon.com. You just need to go to Censorship, The Threat to Silence Talk Radio, and Amazon has a link there. Barnes & Noble has a lot of books as well, and they're still in bookstores nationwide. One of the things I would say to you is that while this is a cultural war going on in America, there's a much bigger war in the world to repress free speech. And this is being done through some Islamic circles trying to encroach viewpoints into Western cultures. They have one thing in mind, and that is to replace the U.S. Constitution. When you see what the Canadian Islamic Congress did to author Mark Steyn in Canada, of course he won that eventuality, but had to go through many, many legal battles to preserve his opinion and his ability to write freely in Canada about Western civilization and the encroachment of Islam into the Western civilization. You see it in America now, too. They've gone after Michael Savage, for instance, without hesitation. They would love to shut that show down. You see it in Canada, Australia. You see it in Great Britain. And I think the world is on the verge of losing free speech rights because of a viewpoint of people who disdain the Western culture. So I just raise that red flag. We have to protect what we have, or else we will lose it.
Brian, one final question. What advice do you have for someone trying to break into the talk radio business today as a radio host I'm referring to?
Well, I the kind of people I look for are people who have some life experience and a point of view. Somebody who can formulate an opinion based upon what they've read and feel and their general basic knowledge. That does take some life experience. I want people who are entertaining, who can express that viewpoint as an entertainer. When talk show hosts ask me what they should emulate, I always go back to them and say, who was your favorite teacher in school and why were they your favorite teacher? And it always comes back to me, says, well, I learned something, but it was fun. And that's what we look for in talk show hosts who can be entertaining. That's what the progressive hosts, the liberal hosts, haven't been able to do to this point, whereas the conservative hosts have. Rush, Sean, Glenn, all these people, Mark Levin, are entertaining. Lars Larson, entertaining. And it's fun to listen to them because you learn something and it isn't just boring. So that's the message I would send out to people who want to get into talk radio and succeed.
Our guest has been Brian Jennings, author of Censorship, The Threat to Silence Talk Radio. Brian, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for your kindness.
Okay. We are going to get right into our next guest. Our next guest is Matt Welch. Matt is the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and from 2002 to 2006, he worked at Reason as an associate editor and media columnist. From 2006 to 2007, he served as assistant editorial pages editor at the Los Angeles Times. And before 1998, Matt lived for 8 years in Central Europe, where he co-founded the region's first post-communist English-language newspaper, Prognosis. He worked as UPI's Slovakia correspondent and managed the Budapest Business Journal. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. I spotted an article by Matt earlier in this week called The Unknown War. And in it, he writes that November 1989 was the most liberating month of arguably the most liberating year in human history. Yet 2 decades later, the country that led the Cold War coalition against communism seems less interested than ever in commemorating, let alone processing, the lessons from the collapse of its longtime foe. So this is, I was intrigued because this is something that's been very important to AIM going back to our founding, which I may get into a little bit more. But before we get into that discussion, Matt, let's touch on a few other matters. Reason Magazine, which you are editor-in-chief, is considered a libertarian magazine, much as, say, National Review is considered conservative, The Nation is considered progressive or left-wing. So on this political spectrum from right to left, where is Reason Magazine and libertarian philosophy?
The way that we tend to look at it is that we generally are the home for people who consider themselves fiscally conservative but socially liberal or socially tolerant on some level. In many ways, the right-left paradigm or description is a bit too binary from where we're coming from. We see the overarching tension to be that between choice and control. We think that individuals should have the maximum amount of choice to live lives as they see fit, as long as that doesn't interfere with other people's lives and doesn't take their property and impose their will in nasty ways on their fellow countrymen. So, we're generally on the opposite side of whoever is holding power at the moment because we are deeply distrustful of the execution of power, and we see government as often as not as perpetuating its own power at the expense of the liberty of the individual and of the nation. So right now, many people consider us a very right-wing magazine because we've been from before the beginning of Inauguration Day, we've been highly, highly critical of President Obama's economic policies, and we're living in a moment that is where economic policies are all important. You know, we have a battle on our hands, the likes of which we hadn't seen since the collapse of communism, really, where capitalism is under incredible assault from all sides, including Republicans, too. But, you know, a lot of people thought with our criticisms of Bush that we were sort of more left-wing under his administration. So it's a convoluted way of answering the question, but that's how we see things.
Are you connected in any way to the Libertarian Party?
Absolutely not. Okay. Yeah, Reason was founded in 1968 by a college student, actually. He was a big follower of Ayn Rand's objectivist philosophy. He sold the magazine pretty quickly to some other people, but the Libertarian Party was founded, I believe, in 1971, and the magazine had a choice at that moment of, you know, are we going to write primarily about sort of libertarian politics? Are we going to sort of overlap with them? And they decided to be a more of an outreach magazine. We're going to make libertarian arguments to a broader public, and this has been much to the dismay in many cases of the Libertarian Party, who always feel like we're not doing enough to root for them. But you know, the individuals who work for Reason tend to have a very kind of richly diverse voting record, membership record. Most of us, like me included, don't belong to any political party and don't identify with any political party.
And besides Ayn Rand, who are the other sort of inspirations for the libertarian movement and for the philosophy you represent?
Well, for me personally, and I'm kind of an outlier, you know, I haven't always self-identified as a libertarian. I'm a journalist by training, and I was heavily influenced by living in Central Europe. So for me, Václav Havel is probably the most important kind of political philosopher or observer of events. And I'm also very influenced by other people who are kind of in that world. George Orwell comes to mind, too. Traditional libertarians, including many of the people who work for the magazine, Milton Friedman, the 20th century's greatest economist in many ways, a great popularizer. He helped end the military draft, among other sort of non-economic causes for liberty that he's been involved with. Friedrich Hayek, the great economist, he from the Austrian school, had the great sort of notion that that centralized planning is by definition going to be inefficient and ultimately awful because there's no one right way to do things. And if you let the sort of chaos of a market where people are making a variety of decisions, that's always going to win out in the end. I would say the magazine is as much influenced by Friedman and Hayek as other people, but there's plenty of others. Norman Borlaug comes to mind. He's just sort of a hero. He helped increase crop yields and basically save the world from hunger back when everyone thought we were all going to starve to death in the 70s. And there's a variety of people, even you know, contemporary figures as rich and weird as you know, John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods, who's gotten under a huge amount of hot water for daring to suggest that there are market-friendly reforms to healthcare that are possible. In terms of core philosophy and looking out there in the world, I would say, you know, Hayek, Friedman,
right.
Rand, Joseph Schumpeter, you know, the author of Creative Destruction,
right.
Ludwig von Mises, these are some of the heroes of libertarianism.
Now, you worked at the LA Times on their editorial pages. Did your views have to conform to theirs when you were there, or were you in a position to express yourself freely? Was it a comfortable work environment for you?
It was for the for 80% of my tenure there. They brought me in knowing who I was, and that was kind of why they brought me in, which was pretty interesting. And, you know, even we tend to think of California these days as just sort of universally nutty and always experimenting with various kind of Governor Moonbeam type of things. But California has also been a hotbed of independent political thinking and even libertarian political thinking. There's Southern California is one of the main sort of fountainheads of libertarianism and always has been. So there are aspects of libertarianism which fit very well with at the LA Times that I worked at the time. But unfortunately, the guy who hired me was ousted in a ridiculous sort of newsroom struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, my views were not nearly as welcome or valued. It was an interesting time. You know, you subsume when you were on the editorial page, as I was. I was editing editorials for the LA Times. So by definition, that job means that you're not writing exactly what you think,
right.
Because you're expressing the sort of collective. But I helped, and we helped institute a series of kind of overall values for the page, and we put them online and said, this is what we stand for. And I, you know, I pushed the bar in the direction of more libertarian thinking. That bar has since been thrown down on the ground and kicked into the garbage can.
So in your article that I referred to, The Unknown War, you use as your, I guess, baseline date, August 23rd, 1989. What happened that day?
That was the day that the Hungarian government, which was at that point run by reformed communists. They were still a communist party, but they were renaming themselves to the Socialist Party. They had begun the process of reforming. That's the day that they demilitarized the border with Austria, incredibly crucial key to the dismantling of the Berlin Wall 11 weeks later. I mean, most people don't appreciate the extent to which the Soviet bloc was a prison. It literally was a prison. You could maybe travel to Yugoslavia if you were lucky, which was seen as a very sort of decadent and out there kind of thing. But generally speaking, you could only go to other countries that were part of the bloc, and you couldn't go to the West. There was a militarized border. If you tried to cross, they'd shoot you. That's the definition of a prison, as far as I can tell. Anyway, so they basically stopped policing the prison on the border with Austria, which is in the West. And what happened is that East Germans who traditionally like to travel over there to Lake Balaton, a gigantic lake in Hungary, they heard the news that this thing had opened, and they all streamed into Austria and into Vienna. And that moment created an incredible internal migration. For instance, in Prague, a place I lived for 5 years, a bunch of East Germans just went to, I believe it was the American embassy, or they all swole in an embassy compound, just basically trying to stall out the clock until changes were made. It created all these pressures when people realized, hey, we can go for free over here, and people in Vienna welcomed everyone with open arms. It was a miraculous thing. I wouldn't put, I mean, I used August 23rd as kind of a touchstone because that was around the deadline of when I was writing. It's, you know, the most important date is November 9th, and that will be, that's the day that the Berlin Wall fell. But what was striking to me in just looking around on August 23rd, this was, you know, if you had to look at five key moments that led to the wall coming down in 1989, surely that would be on there, August 23rd. Others would include November 17th, which is the day of the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, and et cetera. And I looked around using NexisLexis just to see, okay, you know, this has got to be mentioned in a footnote of the newspapers across the country. It wasn't. It was mentioned in four newspapers, all of which came from the same syndicated column. No one's paying attention to it. The only anniversaries getting play at the time was all about Woodstock and the usual kind of baby boomer nostalgia for whatever thing that they were doing. And to me, it's really emblematic, you know. We really live in a time where, you know, I live in Washington, D.C. Where are the monuments and the museums dedicated to the struggle, the conflict that, you know, that dominated my life and your life for most of it? Mm-hmm. You know, there's very, very few. There's one little statue that's a memorial to the victims of communism and not much else. I mean, I can see, I can find easily within walking distance of where I'm standing right now, statues and murals dedicated to actual communists easier than I can find people who fought communism. And it's a strange and, I think, discouraging thing.
Well, right. Regarding that that memorial to the victims of communism, we went, when we saw that that event was taking place, the unveiling, we went and recorded it and actually made it into a video, you know, reminding people, and we distributed that widely because really Ames history is tied to this same issue, which is, you know, we were founded back in 1969 by Reed Irvine, and he was concerned that the media always pulled their punches when it came to talking about communism, and particularly the event at the time was the coverage of the Tet Offensive and how media coverage really had a huge impact on our national security, and communists were always held up as agrarian reformers or revolutionaries overthrowing corrupt military dictators. Our media, you know, seemed fascinated by them to the point of lying about and overlooking the massive numbers of deaths and destruction they caused.
It's astonishing to me. I mean, I moved to Prague when I was 22 years old, just turned, and lived over there for 8 years. And the things that just stick into your brain is just how shabby and dirty the results of that kind of central, benign, you know, wisdom, central planning is. There are whole sections of Czechoslovakia that are literally unlivable. They're so polluted you can't breathe. People just die and everyone leaves. That's because when you don't have a democracy, you don't have people to complain about pollution, you know? Everything it touched. I mean, at the time that I went, this is 9 months after they'd become a free country, and it's a wonderful, beautiful city, you know. But at the time, you know, every store was called store, and there was, if you were lucky, there was maybe a couple of potatoes in it. You'd have toilet paper shortages for months. These kind of things. It's such a huge, spectacular failure. On every single level. I mean, the ones that really strike you are when you just are talking to friends your age. I mean, again, I was 22, so we'd be talking about music, and we'd say, oh, what about this band? And, oh, yeah, my friend was arrested for having that tape, you know? That is the logical conclusion of this economic system. It requires, demands control and supplication among its citizens. And for me, to watch people want to either whitewash that, cover that up, is just morally disgusting. And then for those who want to ape some of the, let's say, kind of economic arguments that underpin it, who want to nationalize industries, for crying out loud, is so historically myopic. We've got the world's most comprehensive failure. You want an economics textbook about central planning, just go to any country that's tried it. It's a huge disaster in every case. There really is no counter example. So for me, it's I never thought that I would be living through a moment when we were nationalizing car companies in the United States of America. I presumed that argument was over. And so for me, reliving and talking about the lessons of communism is crucial to have that kind of argument, both on the economic level and then just what the implications are for day-to-day freedom, people getting in your business, telling you what you can and can't do.
So I agree with you. I think November 9th stands as the date, you know, that the East Germans said, okay, you can now leave and go in across the wall without consequence. But, you know, I think it just needs to be said that an awful lot happened leading up to that day, and names of people who deserve mention, Sakharov, Lech Walesa, Vaclav Havel, as you said, Margaret Thatcher, and probably most of all, you know, the Pope John Paul II, probably even Reagan and even Gorbachev, you know, for finally not cracking down then. But so why do you think this historic event gets so little attention in this country, particularly by the media? What do you think is going on there?
I've been trying to figure that out for so long, you know. Partly I think that there's a sense of guilt about it all, and this really comes on all sides of the questions. My naive brain, I assumed when I was over there, you know, working for English language newspapers, figuring stuff out, I figured, well, you know what, probably back home, and this is the days before the internet, so I didn't really know, but probably back home, everybody who had been screaming at each other in America about the Cold War for decades, they would be undergoing a kind of personal revisionism. They would be saying, you know what, I was wrong about this. You know, Gorbachev wasn't, you know, a totally peaceful and wonderful guy. And people forget, but he was sending tanks against civilians in 1991. He's overpraised for his role in you know, not cracking down as communism collapsed, but he's nobody's Democrat by any stretch of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think Americans on almost every side, and with very rare exception, were wrong. They had, you know, on the right, you saw a lot of people expressing completely outsized sympathy with awful regimes, including in South Africa, for example. Any regime that was able to say, hey, we're anti-communist, was given a huge buy by people on the right. And then the reverse was true by people on the left. I mean, the amount of love for Daniel Ortega and the Sandinistas that I grew up with going to college in the 1980s is just appalling. So I figured part of it is that no one really wants to talk about how they were wrong. Another part is that it didn't happen to us, I guess, on some level. Even though the pictures were incredibly dramatic, and we remember certainly from that era, you know, the man in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square, which was a galvanizing event in that year as well, somehow those pictures don't carry the same drama as a war, and it just didn't happen to Americans. In a sense, it happened to me because I went there and I was exactly 21 when this was all going down. And so, you know, that's an impressionable time in your life. But for the average person who's sitting in Peoria, Illinois, or wherever you want to say it, weren't necessarily tangibly affected at that moment. But ultimately, it's a real curiosity to me because
right.
Americans, no matter what side of any argument they're on, all claim, and I think they believe, to love freedom and to love liberty, and they want people to be free. And so we have this moment that is the direct result of that. Hundreds of millions of people, more than a billion people, in a way, became vastly freer because of what happened. And to not celebrate this, you know, not make this, in some sense, a personal national holiday, to me, is an opportunity missed, and it's just kind of fundamentally inexplicable.
I agree, and I think it needs to be mentioned, and people need to be reminded that according to what I consider the authoritative black book of communism, just between China and the Soviet Union, the number of people killed, murdered by these two governments probably exceeded 100 million people over that 70-year period or so. So it is definitely a blight on our history that the defeat of should be celebrated. But, you know, we still have China, which is an interesting question. How do they retain a communist government, yet some form of economy that now we have become beholden to them and to keep us going with cash.
Yeah,
how did
I mean, I think it's one beginning of an answer is that they are communist in the sense of a police state, but they're not communist anymore for the most part in the sense of economics. They have made incredible gains. I mean, hundreds of millions in China alone have gone from poverty to not poverty, which is a cause for celebration, regardless of any other thing that you think about China and how much, you know, we all find it personally revolting that a totalitarian one-party state still exists and still runs roughshod over people's lives and meddles in world affairs in a largely negative way, especially in Africa, but not only. But I think that ultimately that's unsustainable. As you give people more opportunities for prosperity, you give them more, or they take more kind of communications, more self-autonomy, they won't accept a one-party government forever.
Jump to another subject. We're starting to run out of time. Just got a few minutes left, and I read another article that you wrote last month, and it's called Obama's Lies Matter Too. And you point out that while he was accusing the critics, and you kind of made numerous references to his speech before Congress, he's accusing his critics of lying about the health care plan, but you pointed to lie after lie in his own speech. And so what are his main lies that he's trying to convince us about going forward with this nationalized health program, or how do you view it?
I mean, maybe the biggest one is that he says that whatever gets passed is not going to add $1 to the deficit. His own supporters don't believe that. People who advocate health care reform of his variety, no one either believes that or on some level wants that, but he feels like he needs to say that. He says constantly, my door is open to every serious proposal for reform. Well, that's patently untrue. You have a country where it's pretty consensus opinion that one of the root causes of our dysfunctional healthcare system right now is that after World War II, we had wage freezes, and so we created company-provided healthcare as a way to increase wages without actually increasing wages. And now it's employer-centric, and that means that you are not in charge of your own health on some level. It's a third-party abstracted thing. He doesn't want to touch that. He refuses to change that in any meaningful way, even though that is widely seen as the root of the current problem. So your door is not open when you are ruling out from the beginning one of the most important engines of potential reform. Every day they've been making projections about the economic impacts of this that are just not credible. They are refuted on a weekly basis, seemingly, by the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nominally independent body that crunches numbers and creates scores for legislation.
So very briefly, what is the libertarian solution to our health care issues, problems that we face today?
For me, break the connection with employers, first of all. Put all individuals on equal footing in terms of their ability to purchase health care. Stop the restriction on being able to shop around for packages within states. You know, if I live in California, I can't buy an insurance policy that's based in Nevada. That's nonsensical. If you open up that competition and you make it about markets, not mandates, you make it about individuals, not collectives, that will go a great way towards driving costs down for once, which is a huge problem, and giving people who have a difficult time getting health care to get insurance.
We're going to have to leave it there, but why don't you just give a website so people can come read your articles and see your magazine and subscribe to it? What's the website?
That's great. Go to reason.com. That's the root of it all. And also go to reasontv.tv, where you can see a lot of great video journalism as well.
Okay, this is Matt Welch, the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. It's been great having you on, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been really fun.
You bet. And that's about going to wrap it up for this week of Take Aim. I want to remind you, October 23rd, Friday, at the Omni Sheraton in D.C. is AIM's 40th anniversary conference, and we will be back next week with more great guests on Take Aim. Thank you.